Good morning, everybody. My name's Carla Rowell, and I'm an alcoholic. And I am just absolutely delighted to be here with you guys this morning. It's and to have been here for this whole weekend. It's just been phenomenal, has it not?
Yeah.
These Hawaiians know how to party, and and they're gonna be with me for a long time. You can't hear me? Okay. How about that? Not better? Okay. First, I just want to thank Patty and Marcy and the committee for inviting me out here to share with you this weekend. And for the collective committee and everybody who had anything to do with putting this on, because it takes a lot of people. There are a lot of moving parts to this thing, and there's a lot of consistency is required, which that was not our forte, if you're anything like me before. So they got it done, and it's beautiful. And I want to thank my beautiful hostess Cozy for your heart, your generosity of spirit, for loving me, and my friend Dawn for being here with me this whole weekend, and just for all that I've heard shared this weekend. I'm going to go home full, and I'm going to wonder whose dishes those are in the sink that now I have to wash. Right? I want this to last forever. I love the passage that was read this morning in Language of the Heart. You know, I love that Bill kept on writing. He had an awakening, and he knows it has to continue. He knew it has to continue. And for us, it does as well. And he just wrote, and he wrote, and he wrote everything that came to him. And I'm a big believer in that. And I have to say this. I'm always, excuse me, I'm always a little amused to be called a spiritual speaker on Sunday morning, or to have it called the spiritual meeting. Because for me, in Alcoholics Anonymous, it's like asking what part of water isn't wet, you know, to talk about the spiritual side of Alcoholics Anonymous. What part isn't spiritual? We have a physical and mental problem with a spiritual solution. And I need to remember that first part of that first step. I need to remember that I will never be so spiritual that I can ever afford to take a drink of alcohol in any form at all. That's just so vital. Just so vital. Not mouthwash, not food, that it is poison to me. And there are so many other things, as we well know. If you've been walking around and partaking of any of this wonderful food, you know that there's plenty of it without alcohol. So anyway, I'm delighted to be here, and all I know is that I had that first big surrender when I got here, and my sobriety date, September 25th, 1987, and every day has been a new surrender. Every day. Every day, my jealousy, my envy, my competitiveness, my jealousy hidden under my competitiveness. everything, if I give my day to God, I ask God for His list for me instead of giving Him mine. You know, I do so much better. I am a big believer in sharing what I was like, what happened, and what I'm like today, because I know that someone did that for me when I was new. I didn't know if anybody had done some of the things I'd done. And when they'd say, I did what alcoholic women do, I'd want to know what that was. So I'm going to tell you. When I got here, I thought that it was very important to try to figure out why I was an alcoholic. Why am I an alcoholic? Was it my crazy, dark, dramatic, violent, perverted family? If you had my family, you'd drink too. And now I know that gave me an inventory. But it didn't make me alcoholic. You know what I mean? Because lots of that same stuff happened to people, and alcohol, they take a drink, and it just didn't do for them quite what it did for me. Or to them later on, as a matter of fact. So, you know, my husband, he comes from a family that's musical, loving, and not that they didn't have their regular human problems, but they didn't have to go to school to learn how to parent or learn how to love. They just did. So I don't know why I'm an alcoholic. I just know that I am, and I'm I'm really glad to know that I am. And I don't want you to think my childhood was all bad, though, anyway. I had a great time in elementary school. Fourth, fifth, and sixth grade were just terrific. My mother was a single mother of two girls, and we moved around a lot for the rent. And so I was the new kid on the block a lot, and I was pretty social. So wherever it was we were doing, I wanted to do that too, you know, get in the middle. And if we were at one school doing softball, I wanted to do that. If we were running track, I wanted to do that. If we were doing academics, I wanted to do that. And I have the kind of ego where if we're doing that, I might as well be the best at what I'm doing, right? So I'm taking my shoes off because I think it's going to be easier than slumping over the mic. So I started to want to be the best. You know, whatever it was we were doing, I needed to be the best and the most. If we were doing academics, I had to have all the answers. If we were doing running track, I had to be the first around the track. I was going to be the first woman president, the first woman to run a 4-minute mile, the first woman Major League Baseball player. And, you know, God, by the time sixth grade was over, I was tired. I needed a drink, you know. When you're running the world and you're 10, you know, that's a big job. And I got my first social resentment behind a game of spin the bottle. And I know they don't even play that game these days. They just get right down to business, don't they? Well, we played it back then, and it was that summer right going up into junior high, right between 6th and 7th grade. And a few boys and a few girls were playing this game at my friend Leonard's house and passing around a bottle of his dad's whiskey. Now, these weren't the first drinks I ever took, but these were the ones where I really started to make the connection that alcohol would do something for me that I couldn't do for myself. And so we're playing, and the bottle we were spinning landed on me, and I went off into the bedroom with one of the boys, and we were both doing the same thing as far as I could tell. But when we came back out of that bedroom, they called him a player and me a slut. And I did not think that was fair. I still don't think it's fair if you want to know the truth. But every sponsor I've ever had has told me the fair is in Pomona and it lasts 2 weeks. That's all you get for fair. So much for fair. But after that little deal, you know, and I was of such a self-centered mind at that age, and I don't know if that's necessarily alcoholic or exclusive to alcoholism, but I certainly was self-centered, and it never occurred to me to ask those pertinent questions like, do you have a girlfriend? So I got a reputation I didn't understand, nor could I take responsibility for, and I in junior high, and a rep like that goes through junior high like wildfire. And what happened to me was I fought for a while, and then I give up. That's what I do. My pride kicks in, my feelings get hurt, and I start to back away from my life. And I started to let go, and I started spending more time in the girls' room than I did in the classroom, and hanging out with the other girls who were backing away from their lives. And we'd bring stuff from our mother's liquor cabinets and from their medicine cabinets, and we'd hang out until after a while, school just wasn't working for me either. And that had been my last bastion of refuge. When home wasn't working, I could go to school and feel better. And now that wasn't working either. And I have a little wanderlust. I believe that's God-given because he uses it for good these days. But back then, all it took for me really was a long, slow train whistle and a Willie Nelson song. And I got on the road again. You know what I mean? Just get out there. So I started to leave home with a little more purpose. And I get out there on the on-ramps of the freeways going north and east and all over, and I'd stick my little thumb out there and crawl in the car or the truck going wherever with whoever, and I'd be on my way to somewhere else, somewhere other than here and somebody other than me. And that's just where I wanted to be. And consequently, because I was so young, I started ending up in some of the Southern California hot spots like Indio Jail and Riverside Juvenile Hall and L.A. Central Juvenile Hall. And we did that whole deal for a while, and home to Mom and home to Dad. And when I was 14, I ran away with a friend of mine, and we ended up in a place called North Beach in the San Francisco area. We got one long ride all the way up from Isla Vista all the way up into San Francisco and by this guy, and he dropped us off in the middle of this party town. We stepped out onto the street, and to my left was the Condor Club with Carol Doda on the marquee, and to my right were hookers and dealers and pimps, oh my. And it was party. And we were on that street for 10 minutes before a couple of guys approached us, offered us money for sex, and we said yes and did the next syndicated thing, and boom, a whole new career path opened up for us. And I started living a day at a time in a way I've not had to live in a very, very long time. And our book talks about it. Dr. Silkworth talks about this in The Doctor's Opinion, that our alcoholic life seemed the only normal one. And it certainly seemed that way for me. One by one, little by little, any good part of me, any gifts or talent or God-given potential that I had been showing, I began to trade away a day at a time for the effect that alcohol would produce. And if you had asked me back then, I would have told you I did it willingly. A year later, I was admitted to a mental hospital by a court-appointed psychiatrist. I was a shattered 15-year-old little girl. I was supposed to be there for 2 weeks observation. I ended up being there for a year. I just sort of made myself at home and moved in. And they were not talking to me a lot about alcoholism. They were talking to me about disorders. I was a very disordered-looking child. I was alternately violent and withdrawn and living with a level of frustration down in my gut I did not know how to talk about. And it wasn't until I got to Alcoholics Anonymous almost 15 years later that I heard someone describe it as like being a scream looking for a mouse. And I thought, oh, you know. You know. Because see, untreated, without booze, without a steps or fellowship or God of my understanding, I look a lot like the other mental patients that are in that ward. And back then, this was not a treatment center. There weren't a lot of them, and there certainly weren't that many for adolescents. So my roommates were, you know, had some real schizophrenia, real manic depression, the real deal. And untreated, I look a lot like them. They were giving me daily nutritional supplements of Thorazine, Melaril, Valium, Dalmane sleepers. I suppose they were concerned I wouldn't sleep. And I'd become intimately familiar with five-point restraints, and that's what I looked like at 15. And when I got to AA almost 15 years later, sick enough and tired enough and finally out of ideas enough to pick up the tools you handed me, it started to work, and I got better, and I have not had a drink in over 26 years. Or anything. But if you don't want to go crazy in the nut house, you got to get busy. And one of my favorite ways to be busy was boys. Now, I loved all the boys, but my favorites are those sexy, smoldering types. You know. You know the kind. They just sit back there and simmer. And you just never really knew when they were going to blow. You know? And I found them so very exciting. Now, today I know that feeling is fear. The trouble with guys like that is you're always having to say goodbye to them in the nut house because they blow eventually. They try to lay low. You know, they're in there hiding from a junior prison sentence. They don't want to go to CYA. You know, they don't want to go to youth authority. So they're trying to be cool. They can't. You know, they explode. Like my first boyfriend, he exploded and he threw a big chair through the plate glass window of the boys' unit. Now, my next boyfriend, he exploded and threw a nurse through the big plate glass window of the boys' unit. And so that was progressive, too. And I don't know about you, but I've always thought I should have a soundtrack to my life. You know, music playing in the background of all this drama going on, you know. Some days it's Bob Dylan. Other days it's Jackson Brown. Other days maybe a mariachi band, you know. I don't know. Something, you know, to really bring out the drama. And I remember one afternoon I was sitting outside on the smoke break bench watching my boyfriend Terry being cuffed and escorted off by security. You know, he's the one who threw the chair through the window, and he's gone. He's going. It's the last time I'm ever going to see him. You know, he's going. And so I'm channeling Greta Garbo and smoking my tragic cigarette. You know, we used to play those sentimental jailhouse songs like, "Ooh, when will I see you again?" You know, and press our little faces up against the big bay window and long for what we couldn't have across the courtyard. And they're looking back at us, you know, longing. Isn't that where we live? Right there in that longing? Isn't it? It's never in the getting. You get it, you got to get another one. That one's not right. Right. So I'm smoking my tragic cigarettes, and just inside the girls' unit, I can hear Diana Ross singing at top decibel, "Touch Me in the Morning," and just walk away. Oh, it took me a long time to realize I was brokenhearted and blue before I ever had a real date. It was the way I saw my life. I did not know that what I came looking for, I came looking with, that what I sought was within me. I was always looking out there for what I thought would fix me. And the trouble with that is I was always about half a bubble off what it was I thought I saw anyway. I'd mistake arrogance for confidence. I'd mistake sex for love. I'd mistake brute strength for strength of character. And I'd get it up in my hot little hands and it would dissolve where I stood because it wasn't it. It just wasn't it. I had to come to AA to learn that it's when I'm thinking of you, constant thought of others and how we may help meet their needs. But even that doesn't do any good. Even helping somebody else doesn't do any good if I'm not sober. Lots of professional people, lots of doctors, nurses, we find ourselves in here, priests, monks. You know, there's that first half of that first step. I will never be so spiritual that I can have another drink. For me, that I can safely ingest alcohol in any form at all. So I went from the girls' unit to the co-ed unit to the unit where they put the patients they just don't know what to do with anymore. And sometimes I'd get thirsty enough to find my way over the fence or under the gate or out the front door. I don't know whose bright idea it was to walk us through the front unlocked front lobby door to parent group, but they did. And, you know, I'd put my street clothes on under my pajamas sometimes. And, you know, when everybody was looking just the right way, I'd just, boom, make a run for it, you know. And some days I'd make it and some days I wouldn't. But it was always worth a shot. And I'd get out and stay out for a week or two and then come back in the front door of that place because that's where I live. I live in the nut house. And after a year, I ended up going over the wall one more time, one last time, and somebody, and that was the end of that. And somebody I heard a few months later said that they saw my little foot going up the chimney and over the back and over the gate and into my boyfriend's car waiting on the other side. And, you know, how sick was he? Yeah, I'm picking my girlfriend up from the mental hospital. Out the back door. But they all said, you know, they saw my foot going up and over the fence, and they said, wait, just give her a minute, you know, because that was the end. And he was 22, and I was 16, and I was coming off Thorazine. He introduced me to cocaine, and I think it was just too much of a contrast for him. And we lasted about 2 weeks, and then my probation officer knew exactly where to find me. She came walking up one day, and I was arrested one more time, and it hurt my feelings to find out he'd called her. But that's how I spent most of my adolescence. You know, I would, and the insanity of my youth, of my disease was that every time I would get back out, and somewhere along the line I had sort of started to surrender that I was going to always be one of those little nut house lifers that got to get out for a week or two, but always ended up back inside. So I went from place to place, sitting in front of a judge, waiting for placement, and ended up in a girl's home at the end of all of that. And here's where I want to tell you that I've always believed in a power greater than myself. I always knew since I was a small child I had felt the presence of God. I knew that there was some great power that runs in and around and through us. But like Bill talked about in the book, you know, sometimes the vicissitudes of life come in, the worldly clamors, the fears, those mostly within myself, they would show up and boom. And when I found alcohol, I began to let it do everything for me. Alcohol did the feeling for me. It did the growing up for me. It was instant cool. It was instant maturity. It was instant smooth the edges off my life. So I didn't have to depend on God, even though I believed He was there. And I sought. I searched for Him. Fourth grade, I tried being a Catholic for a couple of weeks, you know. I loved all the ceremony of that. But I'm about as deep as a mud puddle, you know. If it doesn't work right away, I gotta go. I burned black candles for a couple of years, praying to the other guy for a while, you know. Just hedging my bets, really. I don't care, you know. I just want to be on the side that's winning. I don't care, you know. The television series Kung Fu came out. Some of you might remember that show. I used to watch him, Kane. I mean, that guy was cool. You know, he was tough, too. He walked the Wild West in bare feet. You know? He'd walk from town to town, and he had his little bag of, I wonder what's in that bag sometimes, you know. But he'd be approached by whole groups of men, you know, and be assaulted verbally at first, you know, hostile. They were hostile. And just pearls of wisdom would just roll off his tongue, pearls of spiritual wisdom, and you'd see it, their faces change, and they'd go off to help people. I thought, that's power. That's power. And then he'd walk to another town, and because he looked different, he'd be met again by a whole group of guys, hostile. They'd assault him physically this time, and he'd kick their ass. And I wanted what he had. So Cain, combined with the spirit of what I thought the 60s might have been had I been out there in them. I was 12 in 69, so they were over. But I was still looking for them. You know, the music of the 60s, the Crosby, Stills, and Nash, Blind Faith, Traffic, The Grateful Dead, Bob Dylan. Yes, right? They had peace and love and free love, and they marched. They didn't take crap. They marched. And this is our combination. So I'm at this girl's home. I'm 17. My girlfriend Jan, my roommate, is on the same page as me, and we're talking to our friends, and our friend said, man, those people moved to Oregon. There's people and they're in Oregon. Let's go. Out the second story window and down the tree and into Randy's truck and off to Oregon where God might be. And we ended up in Springfield, Oregon, and I, yeah. And my friend Jan and Randy rented a little house, and they let me come with them. And two things happened while I was up there. Now, I thought life was going to change from the outside in. We're going to go back to the land, back to the Aina. We planted a little garden in the front yard, and that's where I learned that in Oregon, when they talk about hoeing, they meant with a tool. It was just a whole different thing. And two things happened that I did not see while they were happening, and our book talks about this too. First, I couldn't always drink the way I needed to drink. I was a terrible thief, and I did not want to get caught, and I was trying to lay low too. I did not want to go back to lockup. I feel those doors clang behind me, and I feel like my life is over. And I die just a little bit every day until they open back up and let me out. So I don't want to go, and I can't drink. So I can't drink the way I need to, and I am restless, irritable, and discontent. Until I can again experience that the sense of ease and comfort that a couple of drinks provides for me. But I didn't know that then. You know, when I've got no booze and I've got no steps or fellowship or God or my understanding, my life quickly becomes your fault. My skin doesn't fit anymore. It's tight. I become very hard to get along with. And when I could drink the way I needed a drink, I was always overshooting the mark. And that was happening again and still at 17. And I was asked to leave a lot. I was asked to leave there and again and again. And I ended up back in my father's house against his better judgment. I hadn't been with him in a few years, and he let me come and stay. And I was there just a few months. And right before my 18th birthday, he came to me and he said, what I know were the hardest words he ever had to say to his oldest daughter, and that's, I'm not going to watch you die, and I'm not going to help you do it. You got to go. And on my way out the door, all I could remember was that one of the counselors had said I was a great actress. And I know today I must have misunderstood, because I ended up on Hollywood Boulevard. Not a lot of auditioning going on out there, I can promise you that. And every day I started my days out with a pint of pop-off vodka, and I would go wherever the day took me. And some days it was a party, and some days it was just surviving. And I know that there are a lot of ladies in here who know what that day is like. Whether it was in your living room with 3 feet thick carpet in a mansion, or whether it was on Hollywood Boulevard. We know what that's like. There was not a lot of hope about getting any different. And a few months into that, I met a man walking down Hollywood Boulevard, and I saw the light in his eyes, and I didn't realize it was orange sunshine, but we hit it off, and I moved in with him that night, and I didn't even know his last name. And 6 weeks later, he's asking me to leave, and I still don't know his last name. But I like to bring him up because years later, he was on my 8-step list. He was someone who came to mind very quickly and clearly that I owed him amends. You know, I'd just gone through his life like that proverbial tornado, spiritually, physically, mentally, and he did nothing but kind to me. You know, so I knew I owed him amends. And in my first year of sobriety, I'd done my fourth step, and he was one of them on my list, on my eighth step list. And I was ready, willing, and able. You know, you just get some of those. You hardly get done writing when you know, yep. I spent the last part of my first year of sobriety looking for him and went everywhere I knew to look. And, of course, I couldn't find him. And my sponsor finally told me, you got to set that down for a while. You got to leave that alone. If you're supposed to find that guy, you'll find him, but in God's time, not yours. So stop trying to force it and just be willing and stand ready. There are some things you can do in the meantime, like try being a friend to a man in a vertical fashion. Why don't you start there? And it worked, you know. All these years later, I have friends of both genders. I know how to be a friend, and I know how to have a friend. And there's right up there with that feeling of being useful is that feeling of self-respect. And I can go anywhere in the world and look you in the eye. I walk into any room and I can hold my head up. And I don't get those looks of disdain or pity or contempt that I used to get from men and women. I love that feeling of self-respect. You can't take that from me. I can give it away, but you can't take it. And you guys taught me how to have that. Right before my 13th AA birthday, I had to go give a talk on the other side of town. It was a hot Sunday afternoon, and I didn't feel like going. And thank God you guys have taught me it's not how I feel, it's what I do that matters. And I went over and I gave that talk, and of course I felt better. Showing up. One of the most simple and profound things you ever taught me to do. And when I'm willing to do it, I sit back. When I'm not willing to do it, I'm sitting back in my living room, and I'm thinking all about you, and boy, you are horrible. And you get more horrible the more I think about you. And some kind of magic happens when I get up off my duff and I get in the car and I go and I see you in the room and I'm so happy to see you. What is that? I used to think I could blow off a dinner for two and not be missed, really. You know, I just... So I went and I gave that talk, and of course I felt better. And when the meeting was over, this man stopped in the thank you line and he said, hey, where were you in 1976? It was a guy from Hollywood Boulevard standing in front of me with 8.5 years of sobriety, and I was almost 13. It's only a very well-organized, loving God could have made that happen when I, in all my efforts to get it done under my own steam, under my own self-propulsion, couldn't get it done, even when my motives were good. So I got to make those direct amends to him, and he said, oh, Carla, that's long forgiven, long forgotten. I just can't believe you're still alive. And he's right. If we're in this room this morning, we're the lucky ones. We're the lucky ones. Somewhere in a moment, within a moment, within a moment, within a moment, we took that breath of an opportunity to make a left turn, to come into the room. I say lucky because I know that God's grace rains on everybody. God isn't picky like that. God doesn't choose one over another. But somehow, somewhere in the moment, within the moment, we heard the call and we answered the call. And every day I have to answer the call. And if you continue to say, a newcomer, if you continue to answer the call, you can be a lucky one too. I left Hollywood with another boyfriend I met in the rehab, and met him in the rehab because that's where they keep them, right? Floating on the coattails of the 60s, loving the idea of peace and love and all that stuff. We just couldn't stop knocking the heck out of each other really long enough to implement the principles fully, you know. And Bill talked about that too, you know, moral and philosophical convictions galore. I want to be that. I want to be the opposite of the parent I had. I never want to be that kind of parent. I don't want to be that. I've got this idea and I can't get there. I am this. All the conviction in the world, all the wish, all the want. So we moved into a tent in the mountains in southern Oregon and lived there till the rains came. And then we moved into a roofless cabin just north of Grants Pass, 5 miles in off the highway, 5 miles up a mountain. This was not your Uncle Joe's mountain fishing cabin. This was an old mining claim that had been burnt out, and we patched it up and threw a plastic tarp over the top, called it a skylight, and then the baby came. And then I thought having this little girl was going to change the way I drank. No, delusion, delusion, delusion. I didn't know. I thought that we were living off the land and we're going to do it different. Alcoholism doesn't care who you love. It was quickly priorities changed. It became, instead of baby alcohol and everything else, it became alcohol and everything else. She got in the way of one of our fights when she was about 10 months old, and I took her up to Idaho, where it's got to be better somewhere else. Got to be better somewhere else. My first legitimate work was in the bars as a cocktail waitress and a bartender, and any normal person could have made a great living doing what I was doing, and I still couldn't bring home enough money to pay rent for more than a week at a time. And we lived in those little rent-by-the-week motels up there, and my kid was one of those kids that you see in her T-shirt and underwear and yesterday's lunch down the front of it because the mom's not paying attention. And after a while, of course, Idaho's not working for us anymore either. We're back down in L.A. I'm renting a room for my aunt. It's about, it's in a place called Covina. My daughter was almost 4 years old, and I got a job in Hollywood tending bar about 35 miles away. Now, 35 miles is a long way for an alcoholic to get to work, so I had a halfway stopping point, you know, where I stop and have my afternoon drinks that got me ready to go do my shift. So every afternoon, I kiss my four-year-old daughter goodbye. And I take off for that job in Hollywood and stop at the halfway point, the bar in Arcadia called the First Cabin. Stopped in there every afternoon like clockwork, had shots of Cuervo Gold and Bud Vax. Get up off the bar stool and go and do my shift and crawl home in the wee hours of the morning and start all over again. And one afternoon I kissed my girl goodbye like I had done day after day after day for months on end. And I stopped at that same bar in Arcadia and had those same shots of Cuervo Gold and Bud Vax, ready to go do my shift. Didn't hate that job in Hollywood, and I didn't love my daughter any less on that day than I love her today. But I sat on that bar stool and I drank those drinks, and I could not stop. I couldn't suspend my drinking long enough to get up and go take care of business in either direction. So I sat on that bar stool and I lost them both in one fell swoop. The kid and the job were gone. And I stayed and I lived off the kindness of strangers there in that little area until I fell into another job and another dive bar, and on it went. And I knew somewhere deep down inside that my daughter was in a much better position, a much better place than she would have been if she had been with me, because I wasn't going to stop drinking. I got married, thinking maybe if I got made my life look like I thought yours was, put it all together, get in an apartment and, you know, do all that, get everything back. He and I got married about time we should have split up. We moved inside and became the neighborhood entertainment. Settle our arguments with a shotgun. That's what it was like at our house. And my first exposure to Alcoholics Anonymous was after one of our fights. We were at the bar where we drank, and we were fighting over whether or not I should get off the bar stool, and I lost that fight, and I ended up with some black eyes and broken ribs. Nobody in the bar feeling sorry for me, just glad I'm leaving. My husband picked me up, took me to the hospital, then he brought me home, and he had to leave for work that weekend. And before he left, he set me up with a giant ice chest full of beer and a bottle of Beefeater gin chilling on top, because now I'm drinking gin because tequila had been making me so mean. I mean, you understand. I was drinking the gin and dialing the phone, and I don't know if we have any other drunk dialers in the room, but I don't know all who I called. But I know I called a battered woman's shelter, and I asked the woman who answered the phone to fix my life. And she asked me if I'd ever been to an AA meeting. I don't know how she made that leap, but she did. And so what I heard her say, if you go to the AA meeting, you'll be all right. So I found one perfectly wonderful meeting not far from where I lived. It was perfectly wonderful. It was there then. It's there now. I went there with everything but willingness, everything but the readiness. And you can't make me ready. I can't. I can barely make me ready. The only way I make me ready is by taking the walk. You know, can do everything. It was there on a silver platter for me. I walked in there that night feeling very sorry for myself. Perfectly wonderful meeting. Perfectly wonderful speaker. It was a woman. I don't remember all of what she said, but I know I did hear her say that somewhere during her drinking career she switched to beer, so I did. Beer's not really drinking anyway. And after all, the AA representative said, oh, sometimes it's a long way between what they say and what we hear, huh? And I tried sticking to drinking beer. Every time I say I drank only beer for the next couple of years, I find out, oops, no, except for that time, except for that time, except for that time. And that's where it really kind of began too. I got a pretty good job for the last year before I got sober. I got this job answering phones for the city of Pasadena. It was a wonderful job. And so I would try to be good. You know, we all want to be good sometimes. Fresh start. We're going to get it all right, right? We're just going to do it right. And there would be some mornings where I'd try to go to work without taking those morning drinks. You know, the ones that stop the shakes and kind of get you even and ready to go. You know, and when I couldn't take those drinks, it would be all I could think about. So I'm in that torturous state of alcoholism where I'm either drinking or thinking about drinking, drinking or thinking about drinking, drinking or thinking about drinking. One more time, about a year later, I had gotten my daughter back for better or worse when she was about 8 and a half. Now she's almost 10. We're living in a little apartment across town in Pasadena, me, my husband, and my daughter. One more of those fights, one more Saturday afternoon where the cops are in the driveway one more time. Neighbors are peeking out the window wondering what's going on at Charlie and Carla's house one more time. The kid's standing in the corner in her mismatched clothes and she got her unkempt hair and she got that look of fear in her eyes one more time. Our friend Mickey says it's not so much the yets that bothered him, it was the oh no, not agains. I did not get up that morning planning on that, having that kind of day. And I know nobody else did either. So the cops left, they took the gun, the husband's gone for the last time, it's me and the kid and the booze, and I see my entire life falling down around me one more time. I'm in a better financial position than I'd been in a very long time. We're living indoors on a pretty consistent basis. I've got a car, I've got a job, and I'm dying of alcoholism more than ever. My first sponsor told me if I wanted to effect a conscious contact with a power greater than myself, I could start by counting the coincidences that happened in my life. And one of the first ones I could count was that I had moved in next door to a woman who had 5 years of sobriety in Alcoholics Anonymous. Yep. She was awake. She was awake. She saw that whole thing happen, and a couple days later she came over and she knocked on my door and she brought me a big book and a 12 and 12, and she came in and she was a woman properly armed with the facts about herself. And she sat on my couch and she told me her story. And in her story I could tell she used to drink like me. And over the last year I'd seen with my own eyes that she wasn't drinking anymore. And what impressed me more about that was it didn't seem to bother her that she wasn't drinking. And that got my attention. Because when I'm untreated and I've got no steps or fellowship or God in my understanding, I feel like you've stripped the coating off my wires. You know, I feel oversensitive and underloved, and I don't know what you meant by that or why you looked at me that way. And my head closes in on me from there. It just gets so loud. It gets so loud that even though I know, I look at that drink, and even though I know that the window of relief tied to that is getting smaller and smaller and smaller, and even though I know I can't guarantee if I'm going to have 2 or 22. And even though I know I no longer have to invite trouble, it seems to come unsolicited. Even though I know all of that, I can't, there's nothing that stops me from picking it up and taking it. I've got no mental defense against that first one. So I don't know how her 12 little thinly veiled Sunday school sentences are going to have any effect on me in the face of what I've become. You know, we've heard all that stuff before, you know. It's not new. It was very neatly packaged. Thank you, Bill Wilson and Bob. Thank you. But they're not new. And Father Tom Weston always says, you got to be pretty sick and tired to find us interesting. Don't you? Because, I mean, it's like boring stuff. It's really plain. It's really plain stuff. You know, self-searching. Oh. So it was about a week and a half later. I just didn't go back and buy any more booze. And my daughter was with her father, and I had the weekend to myself. And I just didn't go back to the store, and I sat in that apartment. And there was no place else to go. No more treatment, no more anywhere. I'd heard it all. And I shook it out, and I got real sick, and I saw and heard things that weren't there, and I sat in the apartment, and I didn't go anywhere. I shook it out, and into Monday, and into Tuesday, and by Tuesday afternoon, I was stark raving sober. And I went back to my neighbor and I asked her what to do, and she sent me up to a meeting in Sierra Madre, California, and that became my first home group. And I went up there and I sat down way back by the exit sign, by the open door, just in case. And the hope I heard that night in that meeting came in the form of small talk. And I don't know why it was, but I heard it. We call it the music of Alcoholics Anonymous. People asking each other, you seem to care about each other. How you doing? Did you get a big book yet? How you doing? Do you need a ride home? Did you get a cup of coffee? Did you get a sponsor yet? How's that fourth step coming? What's going on? Your kids in school, how's that going? How's your lawn? Your lawn? Could my life ever be so elegant and simple as to be concerned about a lawn? You know, like one of those regular conversations that we haven't had in a million years. How's your lawn, Joe? I mowed my lawn today, Joe. Right? Did you miss that? When I was new, I heard Sharon B. at the time talk about a sense of innocence returning. Because it's in here. Now I have a sponsee who's rather bold in her speech, and she says, you've got crap on your light bulb. The fourth step will take the crap off your light bulb. So I got a sponsor and I started taking some direction, and she had a God that I did not believe and I did not even like. And she didn't ask me to have her God. She told me I could have a concept all my own. And she taught me the principles of Alcoholics Anonymous. I started taking the steps with her. And then I started making amends. That first round of amends went to my family when I was about 9 months sober. And coincidentally, that's when the horrible obsession to drink was finally lifted for me. I was not one of those people who came in and was immediately relieved of that obsession to drink. And I don't know why that was. I was certainly surrendered to my illness. But I wasn't surrendered to the fact that Alcoholics Anonymous would be the one that helped me. I just didn't know. I just didn't know. It just seemed too good to be true. But that obsession is like having some elfin toddler follow you around, right? Every day for 9 months. Hey, don't you want a drink now? Don't you? I know you're making coffee, but don't you want a drink? Do you want a drink? How about after the meeting? You want to get a drink then? How about then? You want a drink? So I'm living proof that you can have that obsession and not have to succumb to it. But you got to stay close. I was going to 2 and 3 meetings a day. I felt safe with you. I felt safe with you. And I had this job and I had this kid. And my kid suffered at the hands of me in and out of sobriety until I could get on my feet. I owe my family the most amends. I still follow through with those. I still try to follow up on those. And there's always more. I keep my eyes open for them. But at 9 months, that horrible obsession was lifted. And to this day, there's not a member of my family, as well as we are, as happy as we are together, and as mended as we are, there's still not one member of my family who will stand in the doorway and say, no, please don't go to the meeting. They never do that. And by the way, too, I hope you hear this, too, newcomer. Alcoholics Anonymous is not something we schedule in like an aerobics class. It is a way of life. Then other women started asking me to sponsor them, and I got to tell you, the only fifth step I like better than mine is yours. Because in your eyes I see redemption, and I see forgivability, and I see lovability, and I see hope where I don't always see it in myself. After a couple of years, I'd had you guys, and my daughter didn't have anybody, and she was starting to come home at all hours of the night, beat up and bloody. She'd been jumped into a gang. She was almost 12 years old, and she was running the streets and just angry. Right up front on page 19 in our book, it says, a more important demonstration of our principles happens in our homes, occupations, and affairs. And if I'm only doing it in these rooms, I'm only half doing it. it was time for me to go to one meeting a day, go to work, go do my stuff, and go home and be a mom to that kid. And you guys taught me how to do that too. Yeah. And as much as I did not want to be the kind of parents I'd had, I'd become at least as bad, if not worse. And I had to come in here and tell you that I was that too. That I controlled my child by hitting her. That when I would get so pent up and so intolerant and so tired of what was going on and so overwhelmed and so out of answers, that I would use my fists, use my hands, control her with physical force. You guys didn't throw me away. You came in, you let me come in and you showed me how to do it differently. And if that's happening to you and that's one of your secrets, then welcome, welcome. We're in here. And it can be different. And I had to learn how to keep my hands to myself. And it was time for, I needed to also put her in a treatment program. She needed to go. And she was there for 6 months. And it was for kids just like her. And she found hope. And it was for me to show up for her there. And, you know, you guys taught me mountains are moved a spoonful at a time. And every day I get up and I do my best spoonful. And I go show up there and I go to work and go to my meeting. And I just do what I did. And when she got out, things were better. And not perfect, but better. And she went to go live with her dad for a while. Now that girl is 35 years old. She's going to get her master's degree in May, this May, in a couple of months. She's blessed us with two beautiful grandsons. One just turned 19, and we sent him off to college a few months ago, and the youngest is 13, and every year I share a birthday with him. I say, hey, Jacob, you don't have to share your birthday. His is on the 7th, and mine is on the 10th of December. And I said, Jacob, you don't have to share your birthday with me. You know, let's have one all for you. And he said, no, Grandma, that's what I want. I want to share my birthday with you. But that took time. You know, and I want to tell you, you too, newcomer, you know, we stand up at these podiums and we wrap up 26 years in an hour or whatever, you know, like some bad chapter of Law and Order, you know. Yeah, the law and the order, and boom, we're good, you know. But it takes time. You know, it takes time for all this stuff to take root and the everyday practice, the everyday lifting up and asking God. Making that conscious contact. If conscious separation is my problem, conscious contact is the solution. And it takes time. You come in here, and that's what the fellowship is for. You know, we've got all kinds. That's where our stories come in. We share our stories where that internal thing is happening. Well, that thing is taking. You know, we talk about our outside circumstance, our fellowship, the window dressing of our lives. You know, underneath we're all alcoholic, but then what? How did that manifest? You lived in a treehouse, I lived in a nut house. You know, how did that? And we walk each other along until it takes, and then you share yours with someone else. That's all we're here for. We get better so we can help somebody else. That's it. That's it. Our real purpose is to become, I forgot, to fit ourselves to be of maximum service to God and to our, I love women's conferences, you just know, it is known. Sweater on, sweater off. Memory lapse. Talk about a chemical imbalance, right? You know, stuff happens, and it has been talked about all of our wonderful speakers that we've had that came before. Jeanette, Sammy, Wilma, and then Marcel last night, and then all of the workshops. I've just heard some beautiful, beautiful sharing. Thank you, thank you. And it's right? But I heard over and over again that Alcoholics Anonymous does not remove the problems from our lives. It fits us to live our lives, to walk in, head up, facing in, leaning in, and walking through our lives. When I was about 5 years sober, I'd begun to get better jobs because we show up and we just do what they ask. I mean, it's weird, you know, but 5 years sober, I came home from the gym one night and I took my shower as usual and I went to bed and I woke up in the middle of the night to a man standing over my bed with a knife to my neck and his hand over my mouth, and he said, "Don't say a word or I'll cut your head off." And he took the telephone cord and he tied my hands behind my back and he raped me and he robbed me that night in my room. And I want to tell you that at 5 years of sobriety, I had a much bigger God than I got here with. I came here the bewildered one. Bill calls it that in the 12 and 12, where we had just, I had so many disjointed ideas about God and connecting and trying to make that work. And when I got here, a lady named Susan said, "Why don't you just call him God and let him get as big as he needs to be in your life?" You know, and over time that's happened. Over time these concepts have gotten bigger and better and more firm. And somewhere along the line in the second step, I got it. In the chapter to the agnostics, it says, what was our choice to be? Is God everything? Is he nothing? Is he or isn't he? If God is everything, there's nothing else. There's no place in the world I can go where God is not. So 5 years of sobriety, there's a man on my back in the middle of my bed in the middle of the night, and I don't know what to do except get quiet. I'm quiet inside. I've been here before. This kind of thing happened, you know, out on the street, but now I'm home. It's a surprise. He came in through the kitchen window, and I didn't have a moment. I didn't have a moment. I went to roll over, and I rolled right into his hand. So he stayed there a few hours, and he raped me, and he robbed me, and I called to that God, and I just stayed awake, and eventually we got into a little tussle, and he ended up going out the same window he came in, and it turned out that I knew him. I'd actually watched him get sober 30 days before I did. I watched him get his life, his wife, his kids and everything back, and then I watched him join the church, leave AA behind, and when he went out like that. And what I chose to learn from that is that while the big book tells us to be quick to see where religious people are right, this is the place where I learned the terms and conditions of my alcoholism. This is where I learned that I'm not one of those people who can go home after a Sunday sermon or Saturday synagogue or wherever it is that we go and have a glass of wine. Not the church picnic. I come to Alcoholics Anonymous and anything I do around that, which I do a lot, I devour spiritual tradition and information. But in addition to Alcoholics Anonymous, it's specific. It's just specific to us. There was a trial that followed. They caught him a couple weeks later. He'd been wreaking havoc, you know, around town, and they caught him. And there was a trial that followed. And around that time, I'd had a man sponsor. My first sponsor left and joined the church. As far as I know, she's still sober. I don't know. I've never heard from her again. But I asked Lee E., and he was just a big old good old guy. You know, he worked this program. I watched that man 2 years ago at 35 years of sobriety lose his son to alcoholism at 40 years old. And I watched him walk through and see who he could find to help who was going through similar things. You know, but he was just a good old boy, and he used to say things like, "Well, that's going to feel a whole lot better as soon as it quits hurting." So after this happened, Lee came over and he put double locks on my doors and windows, and he made me feel safe again in my own apartment. And then it became apparent that I needed to find a woman to sponsor me. And so he walked me right up to Marguerite, because he knows that sponsorship is not ownership. We just sometimes need fresh horses and a different point of view. That doesn't mean sponsor hopping. That's not what I'm talking about. Trying to get the answer you like. That's not the one I'm... So I asked Marguerite, and Marguerite, I believe, taught me how to have my soul back. And she said, "You know you're going to have to forgive this guy, don't you?" And I know she's right. I know at 5 years of sobriety we're people who can't handle even seemingly justifiable resentments. I know that, but God, he had scared me. And at 5 years of sobriety, anger was still my favorite way to respond to fear. It was just, it makes me, you know, talk about self-propulsion. It gives me a momentum. It makes me feel like you can't hurt me. If I let go of that, my ego says, if I die, you die. If I let go of that, they're going to walk all over you. I'd stand on the sidewalk and a car door would slam and I'd jump and I'd get pissed all over again. And at 5 years of sobriety, anger's like a suit that doesn't fit anymore. I can't be angry and I can't not be angry. I want to be that and I'm here. I am this. And the only thing I knew was a seven-step prayer. The seven-step prayer became my mantra. And at the trial, as part of the defense, they had a lot of the guys I'd known years before get up and testify as to who I used to be, including my ex-husband. And now that's the mark I left on him, was the fact that he was more inclined to testify on behalf of the rapist than he was for me. He's never been interested in any of my amends, and that has to be okay, at least for now. I stand willing, but... So they told him, they told the court. It was like a public fifth step, you know. But when I already know these things, you can't hurt me with them. In fact, our dark past are our greatest possession. So we had to get a character witness for me, and by that time I was working at a big investment firm downtown Los Angeles. That's a place I never even would have walked in the front doors of years before. I have barely a high school education, and I just went in and showed up and did what they asked me to do. And people like Henry Kissinger walked the halls of this place. He was on the board, and I walked undetected, you know, for 6 years through. And the department head there volunteered to come and testify, be a character witness for me. Now, character and Carla were not ever used in the same sentences before. So he showed up, and they told him all about who I used to be, and he said, yeah, but she shows up early, and she stays late, and she was where she said she was. And see, that's Alcoholics Anonymous speaking for itself. He didn't have to be coached. He just got up and told the truth as he'd experienced it through me. And then it was my turn to testify, and I sat up in the witness stand, and I looked out at the defense table, and that's a place where I've sat before, and I could sit again. I knew, and it occurred to me, again, that page in the big book, that little recipe for forgiveness that we have on page 67, though we didn't like their symptoms and the way these disturbed us, he, like me, is perhaps spiritually sick. He, like me. Not me from a big judgy mountaintop. He, like me. Because if I were to take a drink, I could be and have sat in his very spot. That's what we do with each other, see. And then, oh, you take the air out of my balloon, you know. And I say, well, I didn't ever do it like that. I've done some other stuff. So just like a crack of light under the doorway was just the beginning of the willingness, a breath of fresh air, just that flimsy reed that turned out to be the loving and powerful hand of God. You know, in about 18 months, all of the nightmares and the stuff attendant to something like that had dissipated. And the healing over time has taken place, but the resentment was gone. The resentment was gone. The healing sometimes, when I get a letter from the prison saying he was getting out, he was sentenced to 20 years, he did 17, and the first letter I got threw me a little bit, took me a little time to get used to, but... You know, and everybody surrounded me, everybody got around me, and they swooped me up. Now, I don't believe that God sends things down to have that happen. Let's have that happen to her and see what she does with it. I don't believe in that. I don't have a God like that. But my God did send people at the end to reach out and hold me up to walk through it. That's what we do. That's a loving God. He was sentenced to 20 years. The detective who worked the case came to me and he said, I don't know who you were back then, Carla. I'm not even sure I want to know. But whatever it is you're doing now, you keep doing it because it seems to be working. And that's Alcoholics Anonymous speaking for itself. You know, I'm just not her anymore. You know, it's funny. And I believe that I'm more myself than ever, more who God meant me to be than ever. And to quote Elizabeth Gilbert, if you've ever read that book, Eat, Pray, Love, you know, she says, God dwells in me as me. So we need us to be us, each of us. A nut for every screw, right? A nut to fit every screw. And after that was over, you know, I mean, isn't that funny? You know, like 6 years of sobriety. After that, she's like, 26 years, good Lord. Are we ever going to go home? But things things happen. You know, things happen in sobriety. Sometimes my troubles over my own making. I hooked up with a guy. You know, I was single most of my sobriety. And the first 10 years of dating was much different than my second 10 years. Second 10 years, I went 7 years one time without so much of a cup of coffee with somebody. You know what I mean? It just went right. And that doesn't mean I didn't feel sorry for myself once in a while. You know, my sponsor would get those calls. How come they get one and I don't? You know? What's wrong with me? I'll tell you this, it's a secret, but Clancy was my sponsor for a couple of years back then, and I loved him. He'd never been anything but sweet to me, you know, but he'd tell me the truth, but just funny, you know. I called him and I said, I don't know, the loneliness is palpable. It's just, I don't, you know, and he said, oh dear. Maybe you ought to go into the run a hot bath and open up a vein. Now, let me say this. He knew that he could say that. He knew that he could say that. He said, if you do, though, before you go, would you leave me your stereo? But I had to be caught off guard. We can't afford that self-pity. We cannot afford it. It was, I think Marcel said it last night, the deliberate manufacture of misery. I can't go there. I have to, and Jeanette said it in the workshop the other day, I have to be awake and vigilant about what I allow to enter into my mind, what I allow in to entertain. And I don't have always control about what comes, but I do have control over what I do with it, which is prayer and meditation always keeps me awake, helps me with that over and over and over. I've been bankrupt at 10 years sober, paid a lot of money back, and I just continue to grow. I have started over and over in Alcoholics Anonymous a few different times without having to take a drink. And that's what we do. We got to be willing to make mistakes. I can't be afraid of how I look. I can't be afraid of how I look. You can't be afraid to look bad in Alcoholics Anonymous. And then our dark past become our greatest possession again and again and again. My dad doesn't have to sit up nights anymore watching the news to make sure his daughter's name isn't on the list of the victims of the serial killers of the day. He sleeps well and he knows why. And that is a true story. The only way that, when he knew that I was out on the road, he knew that the only way that he could allow himself to go to sleep every night was to watch the news and make sure that if they didn't call my name, that I must be okay that night. Now, he knew that there was something a little bit wrong with that, but it was the only way he could allow himself to sleep. And he does not have to do that anymore. It has taken time. When I was about 6 years sober, he was diagnosed with prostate cancer, and he asked me if I would be the one to walk him through that. And so I did. I got the privilege of helping my dad through that. And we were in the Ken Norris Cancer Center in the lobby there, and he was being admitted, and I looked out the big bay window there across to the rooftops of the juvenile hall where he had so many times come to court to see the disposition of his daughter. And I have to tell you that both of us like that view much better. When I was about 12 years sober, I took him to lunch for some reason, I don't know, just we were at lunch and we were talking over, and he started over one more discussion. You know, it's like, he said, Carla, I have no pictures of you when you were a teenager. And I thought, oh, God, you know, how long do we have to really listen to this kind of stuff? You know, I've been doing the best I can. Are we really going to go back now? And I have to listen to this more. Get over it. You know, thank God for restraint of pen and tongue, you know. And I'm thinking, I've got sharp objects here, you know, really, truly. I've had about enough of this and this loving kind of stuff. And he said, but I wouldn't trade what we have now for all the pictures in the world. And see, if I'd have stabbed him, I'd have missed it. My mother died in July of 2009 of end-stage liver disease, and when she went, we were clean and clear. About 2 years before I got sober, my baby sister committed suicide at the age of 17, and it took her all weekend to die. And while she lay on life support in a West Covina hospital, I'd leave the waiting room where the family was and go out to the parking lot where the booze was, and I'd drink. And I come back into the waiting room and I just rake my mother across the coals and talk to her in a way a daughter should never talk to her mother, especially when her baby lay dying in the next room. And I don't know how you make amends for that, except that I started by calling her once a week and trying to find out how I might add to her life instead of take. Just shut up and listen for a while, you know? And it took time, but we got close. We got close. So much so that when my baby brother died of this disease about 13 years ago, age 30, 6'10", 160 pounds, when he lay on life support in a Spokane hospital, his heart disintegrating from the crank, and he wasn't going to stop drinking. Mercifully, when he died, I got to go up and be the kind of a daughter my mother needed while she buried yet a second child. And I don't know what kind of pain that is for a parent, but I know that this time, because of Alcoholics Anonymous, I got to be part of the solution rather than part of the problem. My last remaining sibling lives in Wisconsin, and she can't stop drinking. And see, the difference between a hard drinker and an alcoholic is the fact that someone who had just had a double mastectomy might say, a hard drinker even, who might had just had a double mastectomy might say, this might be a good time to stop drinking. I may suffer some discomfort for the next few days, but I'm going to be okay, and I think I'll stop that so that I can heal. And my sister can't stop drinking. The difference between a hard drinker and an alcoholic. At 21 years sober, I met the love of my life. I had known him for many years, and I didn't know that's who he was. We went to a lot of meetings in California together and kept passing each other by. Hey, how you doing, pal? How you doing, pal? We got called to speak at a conference at the same time in Arizona. We had to go to Arizona to start talking. And when we did, we looked at each other. It was like walking to another room. You know, when we ended up, we got married, and my mother and I were so good by the time that she passed. My stepfather called, and when she found out that Doug and I were getting together, he called me and he said, I know you guys are walking toward matrimony, and I know your mom left you all her jewelry including her wedding ring. And what I'd like to do is to shine mine up and give mine to Doug so the rings will be together again. And so we wear the rings of my parents. We're on our way to our third wedding anniversary, and he is the love of my life. He's the first face I want to see in the morning and the last face I want to see at night before I go to bed, and he's my best friend. And he's in Colorado carrying the message. We have an AA life, an AA household. Our biggest fights happen over Alcoholics Anonymous sometimes. I'm ashamed to say. We started a group, Sober on the Rock. If you're ever in Sunland on a Monday night at 7:30, a Step in Tradition workshop, come see us. Sober on the Rock, one rock. I live in Tahunga, which is an Indian word, or a Spanish spelling of an Indian word meaning Mother Earth or something, or where the hell did all these Harleys come from? two translations. Well, we have an AA life, and I'm just going to tell you every day, I've just been so blessed. I just can't believe, and it's, you know, some days are just, you just don't feel it, you know, and I just keep walking till I feel it again. You know, Marguerite used to call those the oatmeal days, you know, and just get up and do what we do. My friend Matthew says some days the next indicated thing is turning off the alarm clock and going about your business, and some days the next indicated thing is something so magnificent it'll make your heart explode. I was reminded of the joy of this moment by fostering a little pit bull pup. This little pit bull pup came into our lives. Just walked up, started licking Doug's toes. He was out in his workshop. Joy of living. And we got any dog people in here? We have dog people in here? Okay. So you'll know. So we just took her in, you know, and we named her Sammy, and she was just a delight. And every morning, you know, every day I'd put her food down in front of her. I put her food down. It was the same food she saw like last night and the day before and the day before that. Same food, you know, and she'd look at it and look at me and look at it and look at me, and then she'd be like, ah! Food is my favorite thing. And then she'd eat it, and then she'd come into the bedroom where Doug and I were, and she'd look at him and look at me and look at him and look at me. Same faces she saw last night and the day before and the day before that. Same faces, you know, just be like, ah, it's you.
we're going to party. And then she'd jet out. You know this, don't you? She'd jet out to the backyard and she'd run around the yard. You just see her, you know, in the moment. Same yard she saw last night and the day before that. Same yard, you know, goldfish mentality. Ooh, a castle. Ooh, a castle. Ooh, a castle. Completely in this moment. When I wake up in the morning upon awakening and I make that conscious contact, I make that connection, and I ask God for His list for me instead of giving Him mine, I walk out and I get to experience that joy of living, the joy of this moment where the God is, this moment where God is, not a moment from now or a moment ago where I always had to live in order to be comfortable, in order to feel like I had some kind of certainty. This moment, this delightful, bright moment, the one I was always afraid of, I get to experience that. And when I wake up and I blow past the prayer and I head right for the coffee pot and I'm giving God my list instead of waiting for His, before I know it, I'm sitting on the computer looking for a fight on Facebook. Comment. Comment.
Defriend.
Oh, newcomer, you have no idea. You have no idea. Come in here. Come in, laugh and cry. Hang on to us. Hang on to our coattails. And before you know it, if you got 30 days, you got something to give someone who has 29. If you have 2 days, you have something to give someone who has one. Look out there and see. What a delightful weekend. Thank you for letting me be a part of it.